Welcome to the debug log number 16. This episode is a first part, part one of two. It's the first time we've ever done that. It's an interview, and it was with an amazing person, Nicole Lazzaro. She is the CEO and founder of Zio Design, where she's been consulting there for 20 years. They've done consulting anywhere from games like The Sims to all sorts of stuff, so it's really neat. We actually saw her and met her at Unite 2015 in Boston, where she gave a really great talk about VR design leadership and about how, you know, stuff that the VR world's going to have to move into the future. We thought it'd be cool to have her on because she also has a big topic that she lectures and give talks about, which is the four keys to fun, which is their basic, they break down based on research and analyzing stuff. They break down the four keys to what makes games fun, from like social fun to hard fun. We'll get into it. Don't worry. This is a design heavy episode. So we'll get into it. So without further ado, this is the Debug Log, episode 16. You're listening to the Debug Log, a podcast about Unity game development. My name's Andrew Curry, and there's nobody else today. Just me. We'll get right into it. Nobody else is here. They've abandoned me. Just kidding. They're all busy. We've been super busy. That's why there's been a little bit of delay in these episodes coming out. But hopefully we'll rectify that. We have a bunch of episodes lined up for the next few weeks on until the end of the year. This one, like I said in the intro, is with Nicole Lazzaro. It's a really fun interview. We have a lot of good stuff. You might actually have to listen to it a couple times and take some notes because we really get into heavy game design stuff that we haven't really touched that topic before, but I was certainly glad about it. And we all, because, you know, being independent developers too, we're all part designer too. So I really recommend listening to this one. It's a really interesting and it's a lot of information that can be useful, especially if you want your players to have fun, which I guess would be the goal of making games. I don't know. Maybe it's not. But anyway, I'll let the interview go. You guys enjoy, and I'll catch you on the other side.
Today, I'm really excited because we have a special guest. She's Nicole Lazzaro. She's game developer, psychologist, and CEO of Zio Design, which is a game consulting company. She's an expert in gameplay and emotion. If you don't know what that is, it's fine. It's basically, it means that she can measure the expressions in players' faces while they are playing a game. So without further ado, Nicole, welcome to the show.
Hi, thank you so much. It was wonderful to be here. Really looking forward to the call and talking about all kinds of fun, how we can make games and VR, you know, more entertaining.
Yeah, I think we are really excited to have you on the show to dive into some of these design topics that we don't usually get into. And because I actually didn't get to see your talk. We all met at Unite. Actually, that's the background of this interview. And a couple of the other guys saw it. And I didn't see it, but I watched it since then on YouTube. But the kind of stuff you talked about is the stuff we love talking shop about all day. Just the nitty gritty about the key elements of fun and how to keep people engaged and all the micro loops of fun. All that stuff's amazing. So we're super happy and excited to have you on today.
Absolutely. Oh, fantastic.
So should we start for the beginning? Tell us a little bit about your background, Nicole, please.
Wonderful. Yeah. So essentially, I am a game developer. I do both design and develop, so design and code games. I measure emotion on players' faces while they play. And I help clients on the consulting side put what we call the four keys to fun into like everything that they do. And excuse me. What I mean by that is that we've essentially done a lot of research watching people play games, everything from Tetris to Halo, Call of Duty to Bejeweled. And we measured emotions, their favorite moments. We measured the emotions on their faces, then organized these favorite things that they were doing, these favorite activities in games, in best-selling games, into different clusters based on the emotions that they were feeling. So curiosity and wonder and surprise, win in one bucket, you know, competition and frustration and what we call Fiero, the epic win, go into another bucket. Schadenfreude and amusement, you know, social bonding, that went to another bucket. And essentially what we did is we used the emotions on players' faces to unlock the four things that make the four keys to what make games super engaging, what make games their favorite, you know, players' favorite games and all that. And now we're taking that research that we've been doing, you know, for the past, you know, we've been in business for about 23 years. We're now taking that into the VR space. And so we've been looking at virtual reality and augmented reality as well. Those kinds of experiences. And what is it about these experiences that really, you know, really draws players in, really draws people into these virtual worlds and makes compelling content? Yeah, we're essentially assembling a set of best practices. We have 36 design practices, design strategies that help make game experiences better, you know, more entertaining and that sort of thing in a virtual reality setting. So at Unite, I was there to share five of them, and we can talk a little bit about that. But we should probably get started with the four keys itself, and then move forward from there.
Okay. Before we move forward, there's any place where the players, the listeners, can download the 36 practices?
Oh yeah, well, thanks for asking. Yeah, there's right now there on our website there is at xeodesign.com. There's a slide deck on the slide deck that I showed at Unite, and so there we're highlighting a section of those, and you can download that definitely. And of course, the video is there. We haven't released the
Mm-hmm. Okay, and then if you want to know those in the.
Okay, fantastic. Do that. And then there's also the four keys to fun. That's available as a white paper and as a poster on our site as well on xeodesign.com. And that's a free download. There's a great a great white paper and poster that describes the four keys, which we will talk about in a bit.
Yeah, we posted that to our Facebook group this week and they loved it.
Oh, wonderful.
The infographic, they got a kick out of that. So.
Awesome.
Yeah, so
awesome.
That's a good place to start then, the four keys. Let's break down the four different, just explain to the audience, I guess, what you mean by those, and we can kind of just walk through each one of them.
All right, great. Yeah, well, as I said, we've been testing players since the very beginning, watching moment to moment what, you know, brings people in, what pulls people out. We've worked on things everywhere from Myst to The Sims to Star Wars to Dragons of Atlantis to you know, all kinds of stuff from, you know, Kabam and Kixi and Nexon, as well as Sony and EA and Ubisoft. And what we've got is this, what we saw is that we wanted to do original research where we looked at people playing games. And what we saw is some really interesting things. The first is that people's favorite experiences, favorite game experiences, the ones that they'll play for hours, offered a wide range of emotions. You wouldn't think that when at first people think like, wait, what? But what it does is best-selling game experiences offer four things. They offer novelty, they offer challenge, they offer friendship, and they offer meaning or value. Something about that experience was amazing that didn't make it feel like it was a waste of time. So those are what we call the four keys to fun. And what essentially that means is that we have four different ways to engage with a game. And what people did is they tended to move between these four different play styles within a single session. So they would start first as sort of this curiosity. So curiosity, wonder, and surprise, those emotions from different activities. And that curiosity is the hook that pulls them into the world. That's the micro loop of gameplay. And it is all about exploration and role play and fantasy, customizing your character, telling stories. So it is, you know, dealt out. And, you know, when you go into a game, you know, there's that big world, big wide world that you can explore before you actually get to, you know, the alien invaders or the, you know, the CSI crime scene or, you know, the Sims. Right. There's that, you know, that stuff. And so what we found is just like kind of like the game of basketball where, you know, just dribbling the ball is fun. You will do that activity for 10 or 15 minutes, you know, no matter what. And then, but then after that, you'll put it down unless there's some larger structure, some bigger goal. And so just like a basketball hoop, you know, is small and high overhead, making it difficult to get that, you know, basketball in. Basketball would not be fun if it were a big, you know, a hula hoop in the middle of a table. It would be trivial to get the ball in there. That's not fun. It's fun because it's challenging. So after the exploration is kind of done in that micro loop of what we call easy fun, the player kind of gets this nibble of like, oh, there's something I can do that's sort of like, can I do that? That asks that question. And they ask that question of themselves, and then they start off there into what we call hard fun.
I like, before you go into that, I like the term you have for easy fun, the bubble wrap of game
design. It's the bubble wrap of game design. Exactly. Exactly.
That's a very evocative metaphor for that.
Essentially it is. It's the bubble wrap of, you know, just like waving the, you know, waving the remote, playing Dance Central in Kinect, you know, just jumping around and goofing off. That's like, and you could just do that. I mean, like, you know, what does everybody do with bubble wrap is like, you know, you pop it. It's like, no, you're not supposed to. Oh, but everybody does. They drive the racetrack backwards, right? Is really cool, easy fun. And it's fun. And it just, it makes this interactive world alive. And it sort of mitigates the frustration from that hard fun and challenge, which is kind of the core, you know, wheelhouse for most game design.
Right. And I guess you could also, I like how you apply this, not just to game design, but also just user interface design, like user experience stuff, and how that first level of fun, it just, it's the tactile. It's the, we went to one talk at Unite and it was talking about how to make your games juicy. It's that, it's the responsiveness and the feedback loop and all that stuff that makes it just kind of Pavlovian. You're like, oh, this is amazing. Mm-hmm. This is neat. This is, and it's just like, oh, I can just play with this menu for an hour. That's fine. But it doesn't do anything. Right. But but I guess it could also translate into just controls that are very nice, very tuned, highly tuned, where you feel, I just want to fly the ship around. That's a neat way from the base up as a game developer to think about that. It's like, just start at the beginning. You put your first person controller in there and make sure it is solid, you know?
Well, it's solid. And then it's fun. It's juicy, not just in the efficiency quadrant, right? That's user experience, which is important, but it's also juicy in the, it just feels fun. The feedback and other aspects to it. You just want to do it. And if you want to do it all day, or you could just be, you know, do with it 5 minutes, 15 minutes and not do anything else, then you know you got something. That's like, oh, it feels just pop bubble wrap for, you know, a while, or I will, you know, things like, you know, zooming and scrolling and swiping on a mobile phone. Those are very fun. Right. You know, and you just keep, you know, you'll just keep doing it. A lot of loops in social media, just keep scrolling, you know, keep scrolling that Facebook page. That's definitely a micro loop as well. And so in VR, what we're looking at is that, you know, most experience, I mean, first you got to do that in VR. You've got to pull, in virtual reality, you've got to pull people into that world and give them stuff to interact with, give them stuff to do so that they feel like they're part of that world and they've got this little micro loop of gameplay going. And that's really where most VR experiences that we've been working with stop. They don't go into what we call the other three keys. And so with the other three keys, essentially, is that you're basically trying to escape that micro loop, because I can give you pretty much any game or any kind of experience and you'll play with it for about, as a human being, we'll play for about 10 to 20 minutes, and we're in that range. Just because it's new, right? Oh, that's fun. Little desk toy, right?
It's like the really interesting concept for a short film, but try to make that into a full-length movie is a different story.
So it's a really cool kind of short piece. And then how can you get it to go longer? And that's where we're at here. That's, you know, in addition to any comfort issue, right? A lot of the reasons why most VR experiences are over and done in 15, 20 minutes is because there just isn't more there. Right. It's like, I've got the micro loop going. It's fun to explore, but okay, now I've explored, you know, this kitchen, or now I've explored this undersea scene, or now I've explored this, you know, this kid's, you know, bedroom with all these toys.
Why do you think that is though? I mean, why do you think that's an actual design limitation at this point and they haven't cracked it as much? Or do you think it's more of like everybody's doubling down and everybody's getting in and putting money into VR, but they're also still exploring in a way, and they haven't gone, okay, now we're going to make the Halo of VR, you know, or whatever it is. And this
there's some people that are trying there. The challenge though is the gameplay, right? The challenge is getting what we call hard fun. The challenge is getting, like, if you have this hockey game that you're playing, or you've got a space flight or dogfight thing. The challenge with many of these experiences is that it's just like, it's really cool. Oh, the fantasy of the Star Wars, you know, tail gunner thing is awesome. And it's in 3D. That's amazing. But then after I've done that, it's like, I've kind of played this game before. And so now I'm just playing a 3D game that looks a little bit more 3D.
Mm-hmm.
So what happens is that in that to escape the microloop in a VR sense is that we really have to have a challenge that really takes advantage of that 3D space, that really brings it home in terms of like, how can I, you know, how can we create this world that I can participate, in an interesting way that could only happen in VR. And that's what, you know, and that's where the hard fun in most of these games kind of falls apart. Because there isn't that challenge. And there are several reasons for it, but maybe we should do the four keys and we can come back to that.
Yeah.
Is that the hard fun is all about the challenges, this balance between difficulty and player skill. So game difficulty and player skill. And for most games, this is off of the computer as well as on the computer, is that, or, you know, console or VR headset, is that you have this balance. At the very beginning, you want it to be kind of challenging, but not too challenging. Because too challenging, if you can imagine an axis, like the y-axis is difficulty and the x-axis is skill and time. At the very beginning, you know, at the far left, you want the game to be pretty easy, right? But as the game progresses, you want it to get harder over time. If it's too hard at the beginning, players will quit because they are going to leave. You know, they'll leave at the very beginning. And then if it doesn't get more challenging, the players are going to quit because they are bored. And so if you think about an XY graph, there's this sort of what we call it, what Csikszentmihalyi calls a zone, which is this cone at the very middle on the 45 degree axis. And we want to keep players in that balance between the difficulty of the game and the skills that they have. And most games will have the player climb that ladder. VR, we don't have a lot of really VR skills, right, that are, you know, getting scaled up other than just being able to use a VR headset. You know, you're definitely skilling up there.
Right.
And so that's why I say that most VR content really still has not escaped the micro loop. And we will not have a true VR experience until we can escape that micro loop of gameplay.
Right.
Now, do you think that's because of the, I don't want to say lack of input, but lack of consistent input? I mean, besides the headset itself, but as for like a controller
it's really more of a lack of design leadership. And right. So in a sense, a design leadership and management are sort of two sides of the same coin, according to John Cotter, mm-hmm. you know, Harvard Business Review, is that, you know, you can manage your way, for a 5% change, and you're really organizing chaos. On management, but leadership, if you want more than 5% change, then that leadership is what you need. And design leadership is where you get a whole platform shift in terms of the qualities of that experience, you know, the team, the product that you're trying to put out. And so you can basically, you know, you can't manage your team into battle, right? You have to lead them. And management is about chaos, and then leadership is all about leading that team through change. And so from a design context, we have plenty of design management because we see a lot of clones of existing, console games and mobile games. A lot of them are cloning themselves into porting themselves into VR and expecting that to work. And it's just not going to work. It's not the true VR. So we're not going to get to true VR until teams are really focused on that hard fun. And it's all about goals and strategies and obstacles. So you've got, and then the goals and the strategies have to be new and unique to VR. And I think that it's really, you know, what's a lot of the money has been going to successful teams of last generation content, which is great. It's really actually really safe management. Argument there, right? But then the hard part is that they've been successful in the last platform, and now they're being expected to be successful on the new platform. And everything they know about fun is actually kind of different in this new platform. Human beings are human beings, but the platform is so different. It's kind of like a lot of these experiences feel like, you know, you have these really awkward controls and cameras in many of them. It feels like, you know, that transparent D-pad, you know, on the first iPhone games. Just did not, you know, feel right.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Right. It just didn't feel right. That's what we're experiencing now with virtual reality. Right. And that's why the experience sessions are so short. And it's going to be the people that break that out that will really help things a lot. Really, really help things a lot. So we will, we'll see how that goes.
And I think it's kind of the design challenge of that. It's kind of hard in an industry that kind of thrives on standards, you know, like, okay, we have the accelerometer, we have this. And this world, like each one of these companies and people buying for this, they have different controllers, they have different setups, because everybody's still trying to find a baseline of what will be the solution that
But that's why we just, that's why, my studio, we just did a game jam, and I just, I'm the engineer, and, I cracked open Unity, downloaded the Oculus SDK, slapped it onto Gear VR, Samsung Gear VR, and boom, we're designing, right? We're creating these experiences with really tight loop, design loop, right? Design and iteration loop. And we explored a lot of different types of options, which, and eventually ended up in what we call our new game, which is Follow the White Rabbit. So it's and what's nice about a model like the Four Keys to Fun is that it can give you, it's a point for conversation. It's a point for having people. It's a tool to design the thinking about how to use about the design, and that's going to be that's what it's really, really useful for. It's not a checklist, it's not a recipe, but it's like, oh well, what could we do as a brainstorming tool? What could we do in this space or this key or that key?
Right.
And that is how we get the conversation, which is why I'm why I'm here on the show, is like to think about. It's so amazing. VR is amazing. It's like the research we've been doing for a year and a half, starting with Cardboard and then Gear VR, is that and then some of the other platforms like Oculus and Vive and stuff, is that it's got more emotions, than more deeper, more personal emotions than any other platform I've ever worked with, in the past 23 years. I've never had complete strangers, give me high fives and hugs after playing a demo, right? It's like, whoa, wait, where did that come from?
We've talked about this on the show before, and we've had VR episodes, and just even talking about this, the just simple, because we've tried a bunch. I mean, not as probably as many as you have, but we've had all the Oculus headsets, and we've tried a bunch of different Unites we've been to. But even just the first time I experienced it, just with the Oculus, the DK1, and you do that Tuscany villa thing, I think human beings are so, our memory and our just sense of place and our memory works, that you retain a sense of place. You remember being in an area, or like in your dreams and stuff.
Memory,
too.
Dreaming. VR is lucid dreaming.
Yeah. So it's like, some of like people, that memory palace photography, that's how it's a good way to remember.
Yeah.
Cause we're so effective at imagining places around us, physical spaces. Mm-hmm. And you just do that first Tuscany villa demo, and just because the stereoscopic stuff and it's 3D, you're like, this is fascinating. Like, because it's nothing of a demo. It's just the simplest thing. The graphics aren't great. It's kind of just a normal thing. But it's so, at once, I always make this joke. I'm like, your first reaction was that first DK1. I was like, this is not very good looking. But then the second reaction, you're like, oh no, this is going to be a problem for some people, because it's so immersive. Even at that just low level resolution, it was so immersive.
Yeah. It's super immersive. And then the question is then you have to break it down, which is again why we use like these 36, best practices and the Four Keys to Fun. Both of those directions are, how do you break down concepts like immersion or presence? What is I can't just declare a variable, presence, cool or whatever, and then assign a value, right? No, you can't. Human beings don't work that way.
Although that would be great.
Yeah, it would be great. But with design language and thinking about, well, what are the qualities of immersion? That, and how are we going to get it? And this is an action in the game, or this is a part of a puzzle. How can we amp up the easy fun? How can we make it, more inspire curiosity? So, in our game, you start off with a game called Follow the White Rabbit that we have running now on Gear VR. And, you look across this French cafe, and you're looking out. It's the late afternoon, the sunset streaming in through the curtains, the white curtains. And then you see across the plaza, you see the Eiffel Tower under construction, because it's 1889. And we invite you into this world of magic. And one of the first things you see is this teapot sort of suspended in midair with this green, translucent tea streaming out of it. And it's slowly rotating, it's in slow motion, and will just stay suspended in the air as long as you look at it. And that gets players going, what is going on, right? Wait a minute, where am I? And so those kinds of what we're looking at in the emotion architecture for Follow the White Rabbit is creating these really deep, rich emotional moments and then string those together into the context of puzzles and an exploration style gameplay, like you might see in a game like The Room or like Myst, where you're going into a cool, really cool space. And it's that mental, but mentally you're reacting to, there's moments of humor and there's a painting that's kind of humorous and you make things appear and disappear just like this magician. So your magic's actually working. So you feel like you're magical and that you can make magic work, and you learn how to do that better and control time a little bit till you do some of the puzzles. You reconstruct, it's an escape room. So you reconstruct, where the idea is you're following this white rabbit. Where did the rabbit go? And it was, wearing a diamond bracelet from the magic performance, from one of the audience members, and a priceless blue diamond bracelet. So it's leaving these little blue diamonds that you have to find as you move along. And so there's that heart.
That's that's the main premise of it. It's like a escape room. That's
an
pretty
escape
genius.
Room.
That's
yeah.
Genius.
It's really cool. And thank you. Yeah, we're having a lot of fun with it. And the idea is it's a story about a magician, set in 1889, who's been a charlatan like all his life until one day his magic actually works. So the rabbit goes into the hat, but does not come back out. And to make matters worse, it was wearing a priceless diamond bracelet, like I mentioned, picked from the audience. And so then everyone else wants to follow the white rabbit. So it's each location is an escape room, and you do various things to get out of it.
Very cool.
Yeah. So that's the idea. It's not a very hard, challenging, the frustration curve or that angle of like how frustrating, how difficult it is. We keep it fairly low. Although some of the puzzles are pretty challenging, I have to say. But we just want to keep players, engaged and moving forward. And there's I think that also touches on what we did with, in virtual reality and other games with the third key. So we talked about easy fun and with curiosity and surprise. We have hard fun with challenge and Fiero, the feeling of victory. You can't push a button and win. And then the third key is what we call people fun. And so with mysteries, because it's a mystery, it isn't really about who did it. Like, was Colonel Mustard in the drawing room with the candlestick? Those are the technical details of a mystery. Where the mystery is really about is it's about the relationships. It's about the relationships between characters. Mm-hmm. And so then what you do is you find clues in this environment that then you start to tie in, like what's happening, what happened to the rabbit and what's going on with the people that were in this room and disappeared somehow, from inside this locked room, that kind of a thing. So all of those are great ways to get people in. And so that's what we call people fun. It's the relationship between people.
And so people fun could even, that's interesting, because then when I read that and saw your talk, it seems like people fun is more about social with other real world people, but you're even saying it like within characters in the game, it could be.
Yes. Yeah, that's exactly. That's, and then, in our previous game, which is called Tilt World, it's a game that plants trees in Madagascar. It stars a little tadpole named Flip. And Flip the tadpole is planting trees, gathering seeds and stuff like that. And so that's a little bit of people fun. Where, you're just interacting with an NPC, that's a little bit of social. And then ideally, of course, you're working with friends to, solve puzzles or do whatever it is in the game. That's really, really fun. And VR needs to do more of that. That'll be the real kick for the platform. Because when people, there's basically what we found is that of all the four keys to fun, people fun, that third key, has more emotion, wider variety of emotions, more frequent emotions than the other three keys combined. And so with people fun, there's actually quite a bit more engagement than the other ways of interaction. So these social interactions are, people basically have stronger emotions playing the same game in the same room than they do if they're playing that same game, but just in different rooms, just, put a wall between them and the emotions go way, way, way down. So that's a real challenge if you think about what VR does, because we don't put a wall between players necessarily, but we do slap an HMD for most systems on your face. which is a separator from the other people in the room.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's something that we're still all working, you know, the industry is still working on, very young industry. We're still working on it. We have a lot of techniques at Zio Design with that we use with our clients to help amp up that social factor. And that's, you know, that's really key. We can actually also measure a lot of interesting emotions beyond what's, you know, published with the Ekman research. We've been doing stuff where we believe we detect other emotions that, you know, from gameplay, in addition to the Ekman 7. And some of those are in that social quadrant that are super important. What we can do now, though, of course, is we can measure amusement, and we can take down reports of Schadenfreude, you know, which is like, you know, the good feeling you have when you're, you know,
other
rival experience misfortune and stuff like that. We all feel that way.
Yeah.
Zach. And yeah, my friends in Sweden.
Zach beats us all at video games all the time. So
yeah, knows, there you go. Yeah. And some friends
can't help
say, oh, yeah. And then the trash talking and all that, yeah. The competition, all that is super fun, right? Super, super fun. And then the last key I guess we should talk about, though, is from People Fun, which is all about social and competition, cooperation, communication. Those are great ways to get more of it, is Serious Fun. And Serious Fun is interesting because after the win, you know, you feel that full body fiera where the arms punch the sky. That's how we measure it. That's how you know. So if you're doing an old Toyota commercial, or your fists are, you know, punching the ceiling, that's when you know that person mm-hmm. feels really good about winning. But that emotion, really big, but it also disappears pretty quickly. And so that's where Serious Fun comes in. And Serious Fun is all about making that moment feel valuable, making your gameplay feel valuable. It can be from anything from, you know, the feeling of developing a skill, right, that I get better at the game, to enhancing the feeling of winning, like a trophy, or just simply like repetition and rhythm, collection and completion. These things make the winning experience more interesting and much more valuable. So I have a background in psychology. I have a degree from Stanford, and what you think about it is that reward system is really important to also to learning, so that you then, you know, kind of seal in that victory and what you did to get there, so that you do better next time because you're actually building a skill. So a mistake that game developers often make, at least when they're getting started, is to not celebrate that win. And if you've got a, you know, really good game makers, you know, like PopCap Games, they put in like 50 features that have nothing to do with the actual game, but have everything to do with this feedback, Serious Fun. Probably the most
joy. Yeah.
Yes, exactly. The ode to joy. Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. So with Peggle, right? Peggle is a parody of Serious Fun. It's like, you know, it's feedback to the umpteenth. Highly
but it's
recommend.
Still so satisfying, though. Too.
Yeah. Oh yeah, it's well, and that's this feeling of satisfying, right? That's they do so much of that, and it creates the reaction, that satisfied feeling, in the various flavors of it, and that's Serious Fun, and that's how they that's how you get that last little bit, and that feels like, oh yeah, I just did it, and it feels satisfied, and yes, completion. It closes the loop. What? So if you download the Four Keys to Fun poster, which I highly recommend you do, you'll see that it's made, it looks like a clover leaf. Each of the four mm-hmm. keys represents sort of a section of gameplay, a collection of game mechanics. And it's important to think of them though as a loop, as different loops. And so people will start in easy fun. They'll go to hard fun for a little while. Gets too frustrating. They'll go back to easy fun, you know, to feel less frustrated and, you know, more curious, say, or they pop over to people fun and feel amused, or social bonding, that kind of thing. So games will allow players to transition between these four loops within like a 20-minute session. So games don't deliver just one. They have to deliver, we think, about three out of the four to really be a satisfying game experience. And when you're developing a game, what you can do is you can use this idea, these concepts of different kinds of fun coming from the actions in your game to really dramatically increase engagement and the fun factor. So it's a great development tool as well as develop framework, you know, as well as a way to measure, you know, when you're doing your playtesting with your, you know, with your friends or, you know, your family, or, you hire a consultant to, you know, do some playtesting for you, you know, like our clients do. You can use that to really measure the quality of that experience and amp it up.
I think it's interesting. all the three of us, we work in like healthcare games, the actual,
exactly.
We work in games for clinical therapy. And in that industry, I mean, we're always trying to, you know, make this our work better and everything. But in general, that industry, if you just look across the board, even we've been guilty of this in the past, it's interesting. And when you define those steps of engagement, and I like when you actually do them in order, like nested engagement, like you have the easy loop and then you have the hard loop, then you have the social loop and then serious. And a lot of times ours are built in social because a lot of times they're about social anxiety. So you're interacting with characters. But it's funny because a lot of times in the industry with that, since they're done by researchers and clinicians and all these people, they skip right to the serious step. They say, we need to have this content. Fun. We need to have this, you know, it needs to be about this phobia. It needs to be about these things.
It must be, it must be serious. And you will do what I tell you
and
to do.
And they never go...
That's no fun at all.
right. And they never think about, well, because this is what they always, because they always want to make it fun, but then they also start shying away from making it hard a little bit or a little bit of a challenge.
So
it's interesting. Just, I mean, I was just thinking of that as you were talking, like from our perspective, we get the perspective where people just jump to the end without, you need to build it up. You need to start at the, and it's like a little, you know, nesting doll. You need to start at the tiniest level and build it up.
Because most of the time the whole therapy is around building up this level of anxiety and then bringing it back down. Mm-hmm. So often these programs will just jump right to the maximum anxiety and you're like, whoa, there was no build up.
Exactly. And then the other thing we often find in serious games have a lot of serious fun, which is why I called it serious fun, is that, you know, educational games often really focus on that. And the hardest thing for a lot of our clients in the serious fun space is to let players fail. And what happens there's a really cool thing between the way that the interaction between these loops, between serious fun and easy fun, for example. In easy fun, you want fun failure states. And that, if you don't have them, then it feels like, oh, you're just pretending to be a game. You're really not, you know, people feel cheated and they just don't learn as much. And the idea is like if you could imagine if you were given the job of, you know, creating a nuclear power plant simulator, you know, you're going to power up, you know, people are going to learn how to power up a nuclear power plant. Well, just imagine, you know, what is the first thing you guys would do if I gave you that simulation? As a game, what would you do? I just gave you a nuclear power plant sim, like SimCity nuclear power plant. What's the first thing you're going
to
do?
We try to overload it, probably.
You're going to go for core meltdown, right?
Yeah.
And if you don't go to core meltdown, get off this podcast.
Right.
It's because it's fun, right? And you can't do it in the real world.
It's a sandbox.
It's a sandbox. And what would happen if? So with serious games, it's often really hard to, you know, for people to, you know, accept that and, you know, for, you know, developers to accept that and take it into, let the gameplay go.
Because I think in a lot of educational and even, I mean, ours are kind of half educational, half therapy, but even in educational games, I guess they get so mad that it's like, why are the people think this is boring? I was like, well, because if you don't have that fun layer and then also, like you said, the fun layer and then the easy layer and the hard layer and even the social layer, those actually...
Right.
They not only do they keep the player engaged, but they also instill a sense of loyalty and like, this is my game. I love this game because it's, you know what I mean? Because when you do that and also you're mastering skills and going to the serious stuff, all that stuff, that game then gets transferred into your thing. Like, this is my game now. I own this. Like, I'm good at Halo. This is the thing that I do, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. And then if you get, and that's what, I mean, that's why it's a game too, right? You know, in the real world, you wouldn't want to go to core meltdown, but you know, or crash your, you know, car, your car, you know, cross the barrier and, you know, jump lanes and stuff like that. But because it's a game, you can explore that. And it's like, oh, okay, that's what that's like. And then you kind of get over a little bit of the fear. So in social anxiety apps, and VR would be great for that. Really, really stunning for that. And then if you can't, you know, go to some sort of state, it's kind of like in The Sims, you know, they start crying, you know, if they go to the bathroom on the floor, right? That kind of thing.
I think people are really systems learners. I think human beings, I mean, the way we learn stuff effectively, and that's why games are the number one, that's their best attribute, is they're great at teaching systems. And so if you just approach some of those educational things, like, or just whatever games, whatever you're trying to educate the player on, it'll just like, well, this is, you have fun and go through, and this is just the material you need to learn. What they need to do is, like you said, it's like, if you want to learn about how a nuclear reactor works, give them that system, let them go to the extreme and let them dial back down to see what doesn't make it overload, what doesn't make it melt, you know, because then they will explore that and they'll learn how it works more effectively than you just saying, this is what you should do and this is what you should not do.
Right, you know? Right. And it's just, and then if you do that, because then it's just, you know, and if you don't let players explore, then there's no easy fun, right?
Yeah.
So you don't get curiosity, wonder, and surprise. And so you don't pull them in as much, right? So they're not even going to get into the game as much because there's no easy fun. And then the other thing it does is it's not, it feels just didactic and it's just like flashcards. It's like, okay, yeah, I know I'm supposed to push this button. I have that in the manual. I'm pushing the button. But if you allow them to, you know, not push the button or, you know, push this other button over here, and then things like kind of go crazy. That's what's really fun and satisfying as far as a game, as far as gameplay goes. That, and then that feels like, it makes it feel like a real world. And so it gets closer to the real world that you are, that you're trying to train them and prepare them for. I think another thing with that, which is really cool on the serious fun side is, like with SimCity, you know, I played it, you know, many, you know, like a real early version, the first color version, you know, on a Mac, you know, a Mac 2 or something like that. And I remember like staying up till 3 a.m., you know, playing because I was just so compelling. So I'm driving at work, right? You know, doing that because I didn't have a color computer at home. And then I drove into work the next day, you know, really bleary eyed and having only had a couple hours of sleep. And so partly because of that, but partly because of the game, I remember driving to work and like almost having accidents because as I'm driving, I'm looking out the window. It's like, oh, you know, I'm looking at power lines and oh, look at that sewer. You know, I'm like, my head's out the window, you know, not all paying attention. In fact, I'm driving. But you feel like in games, you can actually feel like you're really, you understand the core systems. Games are about systems.
Right.
So these four keys are nested loops. You have the micro loop of easy fun, the main core loop of the hard fun of the game. You have a meta loop of the serious fun, which wraps around it, which is the meta progress in that game. And then you have the social fun, which really just spreads all, you know, throughout the, you know, from top to bottom, from inside out. But it's those systems, the mastery of systems, that's what makes games super fun.
All right, that was Nicole Lazzaro. Like I said, that was just the first part of two. And then the second part, we kind of dive more into VR and how those design principles we just talked about, the four keys to fun, actually play into VR and how, you know, some of the strategies and, you know, design leadership, as she puts it, that you can use going forward and how we can optimize games and design games from the ground up for VR. So that's really interesting. It's just as interesting as this first part. Before we go, if you want to join in the discussion or talk to us, you can. The best way to do that is in our Facebook group. It's the Debug Lounge. Now, that's a private Facebook group, and you're going to have to actually either search for us on Facebook and just ask to join, or the better way is to go to thedebuglog.com and sign up for our newsletter, The Loop, which we'll have maybe by the end of the year, we'll have another issue out. And there we'll actually, if you sign up for The Loop, we'll send you an invite to, or we'll just add you to the group. So it's super easy. Either way, it's fine with us. And in the Debug Lounge, that's where our whole vision for the Debug Lounge is, where developers and, you know, even artists and whoever else is involved in making games, designers can get together and just have a little community and share, whether it's the stuff they're working on or some motivational stuff or funny stuff, or really a lot of times it's problems we're having or troubleshooting things. You know, we figured if we can make a community actually where we all know each other, even if it builds into hundreds of people, if we all are active and take part in every day and everybody's positive and it's all about helping each other out, then that can be a much more useful resource than just going to the forum and waiting 4 days for somebody to answer you back and hope it's not a snarky answer that you get back. So that's our vision. Hopefully it's working out great. A lot of people commenting and joining in discussions on there without even us being a part of some of those. So we love to see that. So please join the Debug Lounge. You can also, we have a Twitter account. It's at the Debug Log. My personal Twitter is at Andrew_Currie. That's Currie. I don't know what everybody else's Twitter is. I mean, just follow me. I guess that's so important, right? Just kidding. Do follow those guys too. Also, real quick, we had a blast with Extra Life last weekend. We raised a few hundred bucks for charity, which is always good. And we had fun staying up almost 24 hours playing games. I got the guys addicted to Rocket League, which it was all part of my plan. The whole thing was just to get everybody addicted to Rocket League, and it worked. So hopefully we'll play more of that stuff. And now we actually got better at, we had a lot of technical difficulties at the start, but now we're used to streaming. We've gotten it, hopefully got it down. I don't know. We're dumb sometimes. I'm dumb most of the time, but those guys are smarter. So maybe they can figure it out, but hopefully we can do much more streaming in the future. And we might do not the 24-hour marathons, but since Extra Life, the accounts open all year, and I think it resets and at the end of the year, we might start trying to do this stuff periodically, like say on a Saturday, you know, every once a month or something, or every couple of months we do like noon to midnight, you know, our time. And that's a little more manageable, and then we can really plan out and schedule. This was all an experiment this time, but we can't thank everybody enough for who, if you joined in, if you watched it, it was a blast. We had fun and we raised some money, so that's all that matters. So yeah, stay tuned and stay tuned to the Facebook group for further, I guess, once we figure out what we want to do. I haven't told them yet, so I'm telling you guys first, so you can keep them to it, hold them to it. I think that's good. Like I said, tune in next week. Subscribe to our podcast. Give us a review on iTunes so you'll get the episodes automatically, and you'll catch part two of this awesome interview with Nicole Lazar. So until next time, my name is Andrew, and I'm all alone. See you guys.
Just one person. Oh, cool. Excellent.
How you won. Doing?
All right. If there's zero, it's really depressing. You're like, ugh. Zero people are watching this, and it's just us talking to each other.
I actually had somebody follow me the other day.
On Twitch?
Yeah, they followed me, and then they told me to follow them. I'm like, not gonna happen. I'm like, you literally just followed me to send me a message to say follow you.